If you turn with me then to Genesis chapter 37 and remind ourselves of what has come in the section before, the one we're dealing with this evening. If you remember, Jacob and his family, his 12 sons, they're living in the land of Canaan. And if you remember already, we've seen that there is tension in the family. Jacob had a favorite, didn't he? Joseph. Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons. Jacob had this favorite son, Joseph. And we see this tension developing. Joseph comes to his father and he, you know, tells tales about some of the other brothers. They dislike the fact that he's been given this wonderful coat by their father. Then, to top it all off, Joseph speaks of these wonderful dreams that he's had. Dreams where God has revealed to him that he is going to become great. That he will become prominent, important amongst his family. And so, here at verse 12 onwards, what we see is that Joseph is now sent by his father, isn't he? Sent to find the brothers, to see where they are, to see whether they are okay, whether the flock is okay. But when they see him coming, probably recognizing him from afar, seeing that coat that they hated so much, they see him coming. And before he's come close enough for them to talk to him, before he's come close enough to aggravate them or anything like that, they plan in cold blood to kill him. However, in the end, what happens is they sell him into slavery and he is taken down to Egypt. And we see, don't we, at the end of this section, when Jacob hears that Joseph, the favorite, that he is dead. He's devastated. He's broken, isn't he? Now, as we've, in this series, you've been looking at the life of Jacob, we will be concentrating particularly on what we can learn from Jacob's experience in this story. However, because so much of this narrative deals with Joseph and the brothers, we can't neglect them. But the first point that I'd like to draw out from here, the first lesson that maybe we can learn here from Jacob's experience, is the danger of favoritism. It's clear, isn't it? There's no beating around the bush. Jacob had 12 sons, and one of those was his favorite. Bernard mentioned when he was preaching on that section that Joseph, was the firstborn of the family that Jacob had always wanted. This was the family, the daughter. It was Rachel that he wanted as a wife. And so Joseph and Benjamin were the sons that he really wanted. And Joseph was the firstborn of the family that he'd always wanted. The son that he had wanted for so long. And what becomes clear as we read this part of God's word is that Jacob has not learned from his past experiences. You see, wasn't that exactly the problem that Jacob himself had faced as a boy? He was always in the shadow of his brother, wasn't he? You remember Esau and Jacob, the two brothers, and yet it was clear who the favorite of their father was, wasn't it? Isaac loved Esau. He was the favorite. And so Jacob would have known how terrible, how awful a thing it must be to always be in the shadow of somebody else. He must have known the effect that that would have on the relationships of the brothers. But he hasn't learned, has he? He hasn't learned from his past. He makes no attempt whatsoever to try and treat them all equally. He makes no attempt whatsoever to hide the fact that Joseph, he's the apple of his eye. He gave him that wonderful coat, that special present, that item of clothing which showed that he was different from his brothers. It set him apart from his brothers. It showed that he was special. Here now in the text that we're looking at, although it doesn't specifically say it, we get the impression that actually Jacob treats Joseph differently in terms of work, doesn't he? He has to send Joseph to find the rest of the brothers who are off in the fields working. He was allowed to stay at home. He's just sent to check up, maybe even check up on them. Can you imagine? Imagine how the other brothers must have felt. Imagine what was going on in their minds all the time. Constantly feeling inferior. Constantly feeling insignificant. Constantly having to fight for their father's attention. Never good enough. Never good enough. You can imagine how it must have been in their family, can't you? If Jacob took a cake, someone's birthday cake, divided it up into 12, well, Joseph always had the biggest piece, didn't he? He always had the one with the icing on it. If there was only one comfortable bed to sleep on, that would have been Joseph's. He would have always had the best, always treated well. He was the one that Jacob always spoke about, boasted about, loved. Do we see the danger of favoritism in our lives today? Are we like that? Within our own families, do we have favorites? Do we treat our children or our other relatives differently? Or here within the church, do we have our favourites? Are there people that we are always ready to talk to? People that we always have time to help? People that we're always speaking well of within the church? To put it another way, are there people that we ignore? Are there people that we don't talk to? People that we haven't got time for? People that we're always a bit too busy to help them. People that we don't notice. People we don't know their names. What we learn here in Jacob's family is that favoritism, picking out individuals and giving them all of our attention, all of our love, to the neglect of others, it is destructive. It is destructive to relationships. Look at the breakdown that happens. Look at the effects that Jacob's attitude has on the family. It's not just dislike. There is hatred here. There is a deep hatred. I said before he was even close enough for them to have an argument, they'd already planned to kill him. Cold, calculated, they deep in their hearts, they wanted to get rid of him. And the truth is that Jacob's favoritism not only affected the brothers, it had affected Joseph too. We get the impression, don't we, as we read of the way that he tells about these dreams that he's had. You know, he was a spoiled brat, wasn't he? He was arrogant. He thinks nothing of coming to his brothers and to his father and telling them, oh, God is going to do something great in my life. He's going to make me more important. You're going to have to bow down to me. He didn't try to hide that. He didn't think of their feelings, no. He's arrogant. Finally, Jacob's favoritism had affected Jacob himself, hadn't it? Look at the way at the end of the story that he mourns. The way that he is completely inconsolable when he hears that Joseph, the favourite, has died. Nobody can comfort him, can they? He cries, he weeps, he rips his clothing, he refuses to let people tell him everything's going to be okay. He has invested so much of himself, so much of his hopes and his love and his dreams and his aspirations in Joseph, that now that Joseph is gone, he can't imagine being happy ever again. He says, doesn't he? No, I shall go down to Sheol, to my son, mourning. I'm never going to be happy. Never again. Until the day that I myself go down to the grave, I will be in mourning. Doesn't that remind us of those verses we were looking at in Philippians 3, where Paul says if we build our lives on anything and make that the central focus in our life, the thing that we build our life upon, if we depend on it, what is going to happen when it is taken away? We will be devastated. And that's exactly what has happened to Jacob here because of his favoritism. When the favorite is gone, he has nothing left, does he? This brings us to our second point. The continuing effects of sin. Because Jacob had changed over the years, hadn't he? He wasn't exactly the same as he had been as a boy. He had learned things. He had grown wiser. He had become a holier person. But there was still that part of him that hadn't learned his lesson. There was still that part of him which was falling to the mistakes of his past. He has allowed the sins of the past to remain in his own family. He hasn't cut them out. Rather than saying, no, I'm going to be different. The things that cause so much problems between Esau and myself, I'm not going to let them affect my family. No, he falls to the same mistake. And so what we see as the story develops is that in the same way that favoritism had worked its way into the family, so also had another sin that Jacob knew very well. The sin of deceit. Do you remember back in Genesis 27? What happens when Jacob comes into his father, to Isaac, who is blind, and he comes in and he's disguised himself, isn't he? As Esau. He's disguised himself as the favorite son. Now, because they had such different bodies, Jacob has taken a goat skin, a hairy goat skin, and put it on his hand so that if his father touches him, he'll think that it is Esau. And that's what happens. So in Genesis 27, verse 23, we see these words. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy, like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He didn't recognize him. Why didn't he recognize him? Why didn't he identify Jacob? Because a goat had been taken as a substitute and had been used to deceive, to trick, to fool. What happens in Genesis 37? This time, Jacob's sons come to him. And they show him this coat that he knew so well, this coat that he couldn't mistake for anybody else's coat, this special coat that he had given to his special son. And now, what happens? He identifies the coat incorrectly. He identifies the coat as being the coat of his dead son. Why? Because a goat has been used as a substitute. They had taken the blood of a goat, put the coat into that blood in order to trick, to deceive, their father this time. There is a cycle here. There is this continuing influence of sin. I'm not saying that the Bible teaches a sort of karma. You know, if we do something bad, then the same thing will happen to us. What goes around comes around. It's nothing like that. But I think it's quite clear here that God is saying, if you continue to sin, if you do not seek to correct the mistakes of the past, if you are happy to let the same sins become part of your life over and over again, then don't be surprised if the sins of the past come back to haunt you and to affect you. If you open your heart, if you open your family, if you open your lives to those same sins over and over again, then the sins of the past will come back to haunt you. Yet, behind all of this, this tragic story, there is something that we need to be aware of. And this is our third point. God is in control. It's clear, isn't it, as we read throughout these stories. God is in control. Throughout everything that happens, through this tangled web of deceit and dysfunction and hatred and falling out, God is 100% in control. Despite Jacob's mistakes, despite the plans of the brothers, God is in control. Nothing happens in this story that God has not intended. It is all part of God's plan. He told Abraham, didn't he, back in Genesis 15, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there. And they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve. And afterwards they shall come out with great possessions." God had promised back in Genesis 15 to Abraham that his people would go to a distant land. He doesn't name it, but we see here that this is all part of God's plan to take his people into Egypt. And after 400 years to bring them back out, to bring judgment on the land of Egypt, and to bring them out with great possessions. Hadn't he told Joseph through his dreams that he did have these plans for his life? That he was to become mighty among his brothers? This is how God was fulfilling his promises. It's so ironic, isn't it, when Joseph's brothers, they see him coming, don't they? What do they say? "We will see what will become of his dreams." We'll see. We'll see what will become of his dreams once we've dealt with him. We'll see what will become of God's prophecy once we've dealt with Joseph. They thought that they were in control, didn't they? They thought that by their actions they could change what God had said would happen. They thought, if we can just get rid of him, get rid of Daddy's favourite, that'll be the end of it. And yet how wrong they were. They thought by abusing him, by selling him into slavery, that what God had promised would never happen. And so doesn't it become even more amazing to think that actually, it is through these experiences, it's through what happened to Joseph, that God brought about his plan. Through Joseph's suffering, this arrogant, spoiled young man becomes a humble, godly leader of men who would one day be able to save many people. God is in control. Think, read back over the story. Think how many things could have gone differently. If Jacob hadn't shown favoritism, then there would not have been the hatred between the brothers. Then it just so happened that they weren't shepherding where they were meant to be. They were somewhere else. Then it just so happened that Joseph bumped into somebody who was able to tell him where they were. Then it just so happened that Reuben was already in his father's bad books and needed a way to make his father happy again, a way for him to redeem himself. Then it just so happened that this pit that they had ready to throw Joseph into didn't have any water in. There was no fear of him drowning immediately. Then it just so happened that this caravan of traders comes past at precisely that moment. Then it just so happens that Judah has this idea, wait, let's not kill him, let's sell him. We won't have to have his blood on our hands, we can even make a fast buck off this. It just so happened that Joseph finds his way to Egypt. It just so happens later, as we read on, that Joseph becomes prime minister of that distant country. God is in control. God is a sovereign, almighty, all-knowing, all-powerful God who is always in control. Even when we don't see it, even when we can't believe that it can be true, even when we don't understand it, when these things happen to us and we don't understand why, we can know that God has not left us, and that in fact, he's preparing us. When we are suffering, we can know that God is preparing us for future, greater acts of service. God here, in this tragic, terrible situation, was in control, so that eventually, at the end of the story, he would be able to bring about a wonderful salvation for Jacob's family, the people of Israel, God's chosen people, through this tragic loss for Jacob. He thought he had lost his favorite, and through that tragic loss, the lives of God's people were saved. The Bible tells us, doesn't it, of another favorite son. More than a favorite. This was the only begotten favorite son of his father. This son was perfect in his father's eyes. This son could not be compared to anybody else in his father's eyes. Their relationship was so intimate, so perfect, that it actually provided the perfect example of how a father and a son are meant to interact. This is our final point for this evening. The true favorite son. You see, God the Father loved Jesus Christ, God the Son, with a perfect, eternal, everlasting, all-consuming love. Jacob's love for Joseph, although it was great, it was nothing compared to the love that God the Father has for God the Son. An absolutely pure, spotless, unblemished, unselfish love. Jacob saw his separation from Joseph as a terrible thing. Do you see how infinitely worse the idea of separating God the Father from God the Son is? And yet, what do we see? Romans 8 verse 32 says, God did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all. God the Father was willing and chose to sacrifice, not to spare his own Son, for the sake of the world. He chose not to save his own Son. Jesus was sold. Jesus did become as a servant. Jesus had his robes taken from him. Jesus suffered, and he wasn't cast down into a pit. Jesus was cast down to the grave, to death itself. There was no goat here acting as a substitute. God the Father loved us enough that he was willing to pour out all of his anger, all of his punishment for our sin onto his perfect child. God punished Jesus for the sins of his people. God punished Jesus, the favorite son, because of Jacob's favoritism, because of the brother's hatred, because of Joseph's arrogance, because of our sin. God did not spare his own son so that we this evening can be free. We can be free from sin. We can break this cycle of sin. We can turn our backs on the past, on those things that we have done which are so terrible, those things that make us go red with shame. We are free. We are free this evening to not show favoritism to people, because God chose the unlovely. We do not need to hate people this evening, because God has shown us love. We do not need to be arrogant this evening, self-important, because God has shown us what true humility is in his own Son. This evening, have you seen how great God's love is for you? Think of how devastated Jacob was. Think of the way that he mourned his son. And then consider how much worse it was for God the Father to give his own son for you. This evening, don't reject that. Don't scorn that. Don't belittle that. Don't turn your back on that greatest act of love. For Jesus' sake, amen.